When European settlers came to Iowa, bobcats were plentiful. But like so many species, the pressures of habitat loss, hunting, and trapping pushed them to the brink of extinction in the state. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Bobcats are back in Iowa. This hour, we'll talk about these elusive predators. Iowa State University ecology professor Bill Clark will be here. We'll talk about the research he has done studying the growing population of bobcats in Iowa. We'll hear the story of their remarkable comeback. We'll talk about how they live, hunt, and rear their young. And we'll find out what their presence in Iowa means for other species. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. After nearly disappearing from the state of Iowa, bobcats have made a comeback. They were taken off the Iowa Endangered Species List in 2001, and Iowa State University ecology professor William Clark was asked to study the growing population of bobcats in the state. He is here with us today. Hello, Bill.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Happy to be here.
And first, let's start with a little bit of the backstory, and it's the story of so many different species in Iowa, but bobcats were pretty plentiful here in the early 1800s, right?
Well, of course, we have no way of knowing exactly how plentiful they were, Charity, but certainly at the time of settlement, when Lewis and Clark first went up our western border on the Missouri River, they would have been widespread across the entire state of Iowa and throughout North America. They are one of the most widely distributed species of cats anywhere in the world. They go all the way from the Canadian border and in southern Canada all the way down into Mexico and from coast to coast. So historically, they would have been found everywhere across the prairies and forests of Iowa, more plentiful in the forested kinds of areas.
Now, of course, as the settlers came to Iowa and surrounding states, the habitat changed a lot. So that impacted bobcats. But what were the other pressures?
Well, you know, one of the things we forget is that we settled the state slowly but surely from the southeastern corner to the northwestern corner, and we cleared the land one farmstead at a time. And so as the land was cleared and converted to agriculture, we lost a lot of the native species that would have once been common across Iowa, and that was the case for bobcats. So the biggest conversion, of course, was agricultural conversion. Of course, in the early days when the state was first settled, it was part of the fur trapping history of the settlement of North America. So unregulated harvest, of course, was one of the causes of the slow decline in these populations, coupled with the loss of habitat. Eventually, we got to the point where essentially by 1900, there were no more bobcats or essentially none left in the state.
And bobcats were one of the species put on the Iowa Endangered Species List in 1977. That's when the list was created. So that doesn't mean that's when they became endangered.
No, right? That's right. That's when the list was first created. It was around the time that the same kinds of legislation passed at the federal level. So the states also created state threatened and endangered lists. And ours was created in 1977. And a whole series of species were listed at that time, including the bobcats.
When did we start to notice that there were more bobcats around?
So that's an interesting story. You know, if you look back in the records, they were never completely extirpated from the state. There was always an occasional report from particularly southwestern Iowa occasionally, and there'd be papers. I have an article in my files from the newspaper in Council Bluffs that was in the 1980s. Somebody accidentally trapped a bobcat. But in the 1990s, they began to populations began to increase to the point where they're getting hit on the roads and trappers would occasionally catch them when they were trapping for coyotes or things like that. And so it became more and more obvious by the mid-1990s that the population was beginning to replenish itself.
And they were actually taken off the Iowa Endangered Species List in 2001. But even at that point, we didn't have a very good grasp on how many of them there were, did we?
No. At that point, we knew the population was increasing. They were just becoming more and more obvious. So the DNR decided that it was time to remove them from the threatened endangered list at that point. and then we began actually the idea, discussion between myself and a number of the officials from the Department of Natural Resources about trying to begin a study. So in 2003, we started a pilot study, and we weren't really sure at that point if we would be able to even capture enough bobcats to do a study. Really, we had no idea. In 2003, we actually caught the first bobcat that we were going to put a radio collar on in Lake Okwabee State Park in Warren County, and caught two more that year in 2003. And we kind of concluded at that after that pilot effort that, yep, maybe we could actually do a limited study.
So tell me about how you went about studying this population, because as you just demonstrated there, catching them was not that easy, and people don't tend to see them.
Well, you know, like anything, when you start out, you're pretty much a rookie at doing it. And we really, you know, we kind of knew from, of course, we're scientists. We know how to, you know, prepare for a study and you know, plan where we would trap. We knew that bobcats, for example, liked brushy kind of habitat. And so those were the kinds of initial places that we trapped. But it became pretty quickly obvious to us that the effort that it would take to catch, you know, bobcats one at a time using our own personnel really wouldn't, you know, result in a sufficiently large sample to say much. So we actually began to cooperate with trappers who would accidentally catch them when they were trapping perfectly legally for foxes, coyotes, snaring for raccoons, and so on. And we established a system where that we had a hotline and a crew located down in Sheraton, Iowa. And I think it's one of the great successes of the study, because trappers would catch a bobcat. They'd call us when they were checking. Of course, they're alive in these traps that they catch. I mean, foothold traps just hold the animal in place until you can come and dispatch it. Well, of course, the bobcats were, we gave them a reward. They would call us. Our crews would go out and anesthetize the animal, and we were able to begin capturing large numbers of bobcats with the help of the cooperating public, and it worked great. Of course, we continued to do trapping ourselves to try to get samples in all the different areas of the southern part of the state. We actually did a study. Our study area encompassed 8 counties centered around Sheraton and Lucas County.
So in the end, what kind of a picture did you get of bobcat population in Iowa?
Well, we probably have more data on bobcats than anybody anywhere, certainly any place in North America. Now, we went from this little sort of pilot effort to a gigantic study that allowed us to study everything from where bobcats were found, how they were distributed across the state, and in fact, eventually to do population genetics work across the entire continent. So we found out a lot of the basic things that you'd want to know. First things that we tackled were some of the simple kinds of basic natural history pieces of information that so you try to estimate, well, where do the animals prefer? What kind of habitat do they prefer to set up their home ranges? How large is a home range? A female's home range, when she has kittens, shrinks down to about 5 to 6 square miles, averages around 7 in the fall when the kittens become more independent. They're still with mom, but they're able to move around. Her home range might cover about 10 square miles. Males cover much larger areas, 3 times that size, so on average around 21-22 square miles. They overlap with females looking for breeding partners. Females tend to find home ranges that are exclusive of other females and kittens, and they protect their kittens. And always their home ranges include some pretty good patches of forest. So they center their home ranges around places where there is brushy forest. They like, you know, thick forested areas surrounded by grasslands, not a little patch of habitat, even a big patch of habitat out in the middle of a cornfield, you know, row crop agriculture. Even if it's a big, you know, forest tract, those are not as preferred by bobcats. And they tend not to select areas that are just along river corridors and things like that, because their populations tend to move around quite a bit, and they like to jump from habitat patch to habitat patch when they're hunting. So that was the first thing that we did, and of course, using that kind of information, we could begin to determine things like we put radios on during the course of the entire study, over 150 bobcats throughout that area in southern Iowa. And the next thing you want to know is, well, how long do they survive? What is their survival rate? And we got that kind of information from the radio telemetry data. We would retrack these individuals throughout their lifetime and sort of plot a curve of how long, you know, each individual would live, and then eventually sort of what the population rates are. Bobcats don't live as long as a lot of people think. In the wild, the average bobcats in the population only reach 4 or 5 years old. And a really old bobcat would be, the oldest bobcat we actually found was an individual that we used sections of their teeth to determine their ages. And 13 years old was the oldest one. And those are very, very rare in the population. Most of them are 1, 2, or 3 years old. That's the bulk of the population. 75 to 80% of the population is in ages 1, 2, 3, and 4.
And how old would a bobcat live in captivity, do you think?
Oh, they can live to, you know, average 13, 14, 15 years in a zoo. But in the wild, of course, their populations suffer much greater mortality from all kinds of things. And in natural populations, there's this natural balance between reproduction and mortality. So the other thing that we studied, of course, was when do they have kittens and how many kittens do they have? So one of the other great things about cooperating with the public and the trappers was that we were able to get carcasses. In fact, we just went through the carcasses that are sometimes they're turned in the DNR because they're accidental roadkill. The actual regulations require that carcasses be turned over to the DNR. So we get a huge wealth of information from examining those carcasses. And one of the things we can get is basic information about what proportion of the females become pregnant and how many kittens they have. So,
well, we'll explore that part of their life cycle in just a moment. But before, we have to take a break here in just a moment. But I want to establish one of the interesting things about bobcats is, although they were endangered in Iowa and the DNR has helped to bring back a number of different species in Iowa that had been endangered, the DNR didn't have anything to do with this bobcat comeback, right?
No, this was all natural. Of course, we don't know exactly when the first bobcats, whether it was just bobcats beginning to increase their populations or basically dispersing in from nearby states. But after the break, we can talk about where they came from, because we have genetic data that shows that their cousins live in places like northern Missouri and Kansas and southern Nebraska. And so they kind of came from the south and west.
All right. Well, we will take a short break right now. Right now, I'm talking with Iowa State University ecology professor Bill Clark, and we're talking about the research he's done on the bobcat population in Iowa. And if you go to our Facebook page at Iowa Public Radio, you can find a link to his page about population dynamics, distribution, and landscape genetics of bobcats in Iowa. We'd also love to hear from you. Have you had a bobcat encounter in Iowa? Let us know. 866-780-9100. Bill will also answer your questions. 866-780-9100. You can email us at talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Iowa State University ecology professor William Clark. And today we're talking about bobcats, a species that nearly disappeared from the state of Iowa and has made a remarkable comeback. And Bill has been involved in a long-term study of the population of bobcats in the state. And Bill, I want to ask, first of all, you studied bobcats in the southern part of Iowa, and that seems to be where we have more bobcats. But when you were describing the kind of habitat they like, why wouldn't we have more bobcats in other parts of the state as well?
That's one of the great mysteries and one of the things we really still don't completely understand. We know a lot about how they disperse across the landscape. Males move pretty long distances. They might go 50 miles between where they're born and where they eventually set up a home range. Females, much shorter distances, 15 miles or so. We had one bobcat, one of our radioed bobcats, actually went all the way to Lincoln, Nebraska. So we've had them go 150 miles. So they'll move long distances. But in order to set up a home range and a sort of establish a population, the females kind of, you might say, hopscotch across the landscape. You know, their daughters move the 10 to 15 miles away, and then their daughters move, and so on and so forth. And southern Iowa has this nice mixture of brushy forest and grassland and agricultural lands, lots of pasture, lots of prey types and things like that. And so, and up the Lus Hills of western Iowa and southeastern Iowa, populations continue, but they're to grow. But there are some barriers to movement into northeastern Iowa. Now, there's certainly bobcats up in northeastern Iowa, and we're not quite sure why that population doesn't grow a little more just on its own. Certainly, there are some barriers to dispersal. If you think about the way the rivers run in Iowa, they all run from, at least in eastern Iowa, from the northwest corner to the southeast. And so if you're a dispersing bobcat, there's no real sort of corridor to follow that would take you from south central Iowa directly up to northeastern Iowa. So dispersal is a little more difficult in that direction. We actually think that it's most likely, and we're beginning to see this in the genetic data, that they'll move south from places like Wisconsin, especially. But northeastern Iowa forests are a little different, and their population growth is probably dependent upon habitat quality to a certain degree. The forests up there are larger trees, more mature forests. Lots less understory. If you've walked around in places like Yellow River Forest and the state parks up there, you realize that, you know, you're kind of in a different forest type. It's not quite as good habitat for bobcats. There's not as much brushy forested habitat that they really thrive in. And we think that has something to do with why their populations are more slowly increasing in those areas. Certainly they're there, and the population does seem to be expanding in adjacent areas in Wisconsin and southern Minnesota, but
well,
much
you
more
mentioned,
slowly than southern Iowa.
You mentioned that you had done DNA or genetic research on the bobcats that you caught. So where did those bobcats come from? Do you know?
Well, yeah. So we know a lot about the genetics of bobcats across, the entire continent now. I had a PhD student, Dawn Redding, who's now on the faculty at Luther College, who did all this wonderful work. And she was able to establish the linkages from Iowa, as I said earlier, were mostly all bobcat cousins throughout southern Iowa and up the Lus Hills area and so on. All the Iowa bobcats really have their strongest genetic connections to cousins in northern Missouri and Kansas and southern Nebraska. And not so much, even the bobcats in western Iowa, not so much to those up in the northern plains like in the Dakotas. Bobcats in northeastern Iowa appear to have kind of a mixture. They have some genes from cousins that slowly seem to be dispersing in from Minnesota and Wisconsin, especially Wisconsin, and a little bit from Illinois. So they're a little more mixed genetically. Remarkably, though, when you look across the entire country, there are very distinctive sort of subgroups, what we would describe as subgroups, not really subspecies, but genetically distinct, and we can distinguish many different genetically distinct groups across all of North America.
With some species that were endangered or on the brink of disappearing, there are problems with the gene pool because of inbreeding. When you look at the genetics of bobcats, is it a strong gene pool?
It is very strong. Lots of diversity, tremendous diversity of types across the continent, including many different, especially in the eastern half. It's kind of interesting. If you go all the way back to the time of the Pleistocene, when North America, of course, the whole northern part of Iowa was covered in ice and the glaciers had descended. So populations in places like Minnesota, northern Minnesota and northern Wisconsin and New England, bobcats didn't exist. There was ice there. And so they repopulated from the south. In the western United States, the population is kind of one. There was one big refuge in that area where we can see back to the time of the ice melting in the Pleistocene at the end around 11,000 years ago, and another big refuge of bobcats in the east. So all of them sort of spread north. And in the east, Eventually, we saw a lot of sort of differentiation. It's a younger population, and we still see that differentiation. In the West, not so much, all the way until you get to the West Coast. And then the very Western population just on the other side of the Cascades are genetically distinct.
Do you have the ability to put a rough number on the bobcat population in Iowa? Obviously, we don't know where all of them are. We haven't seen all of them, but do you have an idea?
We do. It's a very hard number to come up with, and we have not able. We're not able to, you know, sort of mark and recapture and sort of statistically estimate this number as precisely as we would like. But using reasonable assumptions and so on, we calculate that there's about a couple thousand bobcats in the state of Iowa, almost all in the southern part of the state. The south of Interstate 80 would be the bulk of the population, 90%, except for the western part of the counties, up to Woodbury County and the western counties. And then the remaining 10% or so, maybe it's 15% in the northern part of the state. So a couple thousand bobcats, we could be off by, you know, 500, but that's pretty close ballpark, 2,000, 2,500, maybe, you know, we're pushing 3,000 as the population continues to expand, but probably not much more than those numbers.
All right, we're talking about bobcats today. My guest is Iowa State University Ecology Professor Bill Clark, and you're welcome to join our conversation as well at 866-780-9100. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org or tweet us at IPRTalk. Mark is on the line from Indianola. Hi, Mark.
Hey, good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, listen, it sounds like there's a lot we don't know about bobcats and how their numbers are, what their numbers are doing or what the numbers are. It sounds like you're doing some groundbreaking research on them, which is a good thing. I live in southern Iowa, and I spend a lot of time out in the timber, and I've only seen two in my life so far in the wild. And I'm wondering just how the DNR can justify now proposing to the Protection Commission that we take the cap off of the killing of bobcats and river otters. They're doing that both at the next meeting, and I'm wondering how in the world they can justify that, given the fact that they had nothing to do with the numbers coming back in the state, and there's still a lot that they don't know about the numbers.
Mark, thanks a lot for your call. And Bill, you don't make that policy, but can you comment on hunting?
Absolutely, yeah. Sure. It's a good question. So first of all, Mark, let me say that you're a lucky guy that you've seen a couple of bobcats. I've been working on them for a long time, and I have yet to see one when I've just been sitting in the woods. Even with radio telemetry devices around their neck, they're pretty hard to spot sometimes. Certainly the way that the decisions are made is that we use the population data to project both the rates of increase of the population based on the reproduction and mortality rates that I spoke about and the rough estimates of the size of the population. And then I help to provide that kind of information to the DNR. The DNR ultimately has the responsibility for making the regulations. Last year, the quota was 450 bobcats. This year, they have proposed to remove the cap. I think part of the reason that they have proposed that is that in practical terms, it's difficult to regulate. And there are a lot of the bobcats that are the regulations say that once a bobcat is taken outside of the quota, that is beyond the quota, it has to be turned over to the DNR. So one justification in their mind is that, we should just allow the trapper to keep those animals, and if they decide to sell the fur or have a mount made or whatever, that's not a waste of the resource. Otherwise, those pelts actually go to the DNR and they sell them. Exactly how much the harvest will increase without any cap is an unknown at this point. And you might say you'd have to ask the DNR what they hope to do if, for example, harvest tends to get a little out of hand. I'm sure they will, plan to put some kind of quota back in place if that seems to be the case.
We were just talking numbers, Bill, and from what I was hearing, there could be as few as about 2,000. There could be as many as about 3,000. But the quota last year was 450 bobcats, which could be almost as much as a quarter of the population in Iowa. Doesn't that seem like a high quota considering how few there are?
No, we actually estimate that quota based on the rate of increase of the population. And the population has been growing at a rate of somewhere around 8 to 10% per year. So with a quota like that, what tends to happen is that the population replaces itself. And so you have production of young individuals, new individuals into the population, replacing the ones that are removed. And when you track the population over time, the result is we're about level with the rates of increase. What will probably happen as we increase the harvest on the populations is that it will slow not only the population growth down, but probably slow down the spread of bobcats into other areas of the state where they aren't very abundant now.
Mark, thanks a lot for your call. And we've talked a lot about the population of bobcats, but we haven't really talked that much about bobcats themselves. So, Bill, how big are bobcats?
Females weigh about 18 pounds would be a normal-sized adult female. Males, a normal-sized adult male would be about 25 pounds. They're much smaller than most people realize. You know, a big, fat, overweight house cat can weigh 15 to 18 pounds. Bobcats look bigger than they are because they have fluffy fur and they have long legs, relatively speaking, so that they can sprint and grab prey and so on. So they look taller and more lanky than they really are in terms of body weight. And as I said earlier, you know, in the wild, a mature female would be, you know, around 3 years old, and it's those 2-, 3-, and 4-year-old females that produce most of the offspring in the population.
How old are bobcats when they start being able to reproduce? Is that the first year?
Nope, not until their second year. So they go through their whole first year. They stay with mom until about Christmas time or into the spring. They're born in May, so they'll be about a year old and when they sort of disperse away from mom's home range. And then not until the following fall do they become sexually mature, and then they begin breeding activity in January, February. So they won't give birth until about the time of their own first or second birthday.
And about how many kittens would a female have?
So in that first time of pregnancy, when the female's about 2 years old, only about 60 to 65% of those females become sexually mature and breed for that first time. And they usually have a little bit smaller litters. And then the rest of the population, the adults that are 3, 4, 5 years old, have litters that average a little over 3, so 3 or 4 kittens. And most of those females, about 85%, maybe 90% of those females are giving birth every year.
And the females, do they rear the young on their own?
Yep. Yep. They stay with the kittens, and we frequently get sightings of individuals that see mom and half-grown kittens in the early fall. In fact, one of the ways that we keep track of the population is through a bow hunter observation survey. So all the deer hunters who are out there with their bows in the fall are one of our primary ways of reporting bobcats to us, and that's how we get trend information. And we get lots and lots of reports that, you know, I saw a female bobcat and 2 kittens come walking, you know, past me in the woods.
Well, and you were talking about how Mark was a lucky guy for seeing bobcats at all, and I'm feeling terribly jealous of the people who spot a bobcat mother with kittens. How can you see them? I mean, very few people do.
That's a great way to do it. Is really, you know, if you're inclined to sit in a blind, and of course, if you go in the right kind of habitat. And you want to go to places where bobcats are fairly abundant. So if you went to, like the state forest, Stevens State Forest in southern Iowa, and sat in a blind in brushy habitat, you would probably only have to sit there for maybe 2 or 3, if you're lucky, maybe 2, of course, you probably wouldn't be this lucky, but 2 or 3 days, you know, of time in a deer stand, so to speak, in southern Iowa. But, you know, up in northeastern Iowa, you'd have to sit there for 2 or 3 years.
All right. Well, if I have 2 or 3 years available, maybe I'll do that sometime. Fred is on the line in Grinnell next. Hi, Fred.
See, would bobcats and feral house cats interbreed? And is there a specific habitat that bobcats don't like cornfields and bean fields with no fence rows?
All right, well, let's start with that first question. Do bobcats and house cats have enough in common that they might think about that?
No. In fact, they're in two completely different genera. They do have the same number of chromosomes, but they do not interbreed. There's actually myths out on the literature, or out on the web, where you can go and buy what are known as pixie bobs. And typically they're advertised as crosses between bobcats and domestic cats. They are, in fact, just domestic cats that kind of look bobcat-like. So don't get taken in by an ad for a pixie bob. They won't interbreed, and normally would. In fact, bobcats might even try to eat a house cat in the right circumstances.
And we talked about the kind of environment that they like. How about that they hate, that they couldn't live in?
They clearly do not. The reason they're not found in northern Iowa, in fact, I'm not sure that we'll ever see resident populations, is because in the northern part of the state, where we have predominant land use of row crop agriculture, corn and soybean agriculture, that is not bobcat habitat. Now, they'll occasionally wander through those areas. We had one that was a male that was captured by a trapper in a ditch in up near Garner in north central Iowa, headed somewhere, but they're just passing through when they're doing those kinds of things. They are not going to use those kinds of habitats to establish a home range and a permanent resident.
All right, I'm talking with Dr. Bill Clark. We're talking about the bobcat population in Iowa, a population that has been growing significantly over the past 20 years or so. We'll continue our conversation about bobcats in just a moment, and you're welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest right now is Iowa State University Ecology Professor William Clark. And this hour, we're talking about bobcats, an animal that's made an amazing comeback in the state of Iowa, from once being listed on the Iowa Endangered Species List, being taken off that list in 2001. Now, maybe as many as about 3,000 bobcats living in the state of Iowa. And Bill, you've mentioned several times prey. You know, obviously these are predators. What do bobcats eat?
They love bunnies. That's a short answer, Charity, but they are really, that's their primary prey. Cottontail rabbits is their number one prey. They eat mice and meadow mice and voles, and those sorts of things are sort of their next most popular thing. The fox squirrels are easy prey for bobcats, especially along the forest edges where they hunt. And so those three items really make up about 90% or more of their diet.
All right. And so when you were talking earlier about them preferring a brushy forest, that sounds like a perfect place for bunnies, too.
Right, right.
How do they hunt?
So they're spot and stalk predators. You know, if you look at a bobcat's face, they have, their eyes facing forward. They hunt at dawn and dusk. They spot their prey. They sneak up just like your house cat would. And you've seen them kind of make a creep, and then they make a quick lunge. And, of course, they would use their sharp claws to pin the animal, and then a quick bite to the back of the head or neck, depending on the size of the prey, and it's all over. People often ask, domestic cats catch a lot of birds around our bird feeders and yards and things like that. Bobcats, we've done some food habit study, and although we haven't studied it throughout the nesting season of the birds, we find relatively little birds in their diet. You know, we find the odd feathers from turkeys and pheasants occasionally. They're really not found in grasslands very much, so they're not preying on pheasants. Turkey poults occasionally in the spring, and adults occasionally. A big turkey is too big for a bobcat to really tackle. They prefer smaller prey. The odd, other kind of songbird and things like that. So they're not nearly as big a bird predator as you might think. They really prefer mammals. They do occasionally catch fawns, so there are certainly studies that show that they will catch deer fawns, and probably occasionally a big male in some places will try to tackle an adult deer, but that's very unusual.
I was going to say that would have to be a big bobcat and a small deer.
Right.
You mentioned that they hunt at dawn and dusk, and they're nocturnal?
Well, they really peak their activities in those hours as we go through sunset and then through, you know, 10 or 11, 12 o'clock at night. Then they'll kind of slow down. We track them all night, so we know. And they'll slow down and kind of they'll just lay around for a while in the middle of the night and not do much of anything. And then as the dawn is beginning to break, they begin to pick up their activity again. So, you know, 4 or 5 o'clock, 5 o'clock in the morning, they're starting to stalk along the edges of their hunting habitat looking for prey that are, you know, beginning to be active at that time of the day.
Well, they're not the same as house cats, but that sounds like pretty typical house cat behavior.
Yeah, it
too
does.
When they actually stalk their prey on the ground, if they have to chase, how fast can they go?
For short distances, they're quick and agile, but they're not really built for long distance chases. They try to get as close as they can, and, you know, a long sprint for them, not that they can't run, but, you know, a long attack would probably be something in the neighborhood of 20 to 30 yards would be a long one. And most of the time they're trying to get much closer than that. 10 yards away, sneak up on that, you know, bunny that's sitting along the edge of the forest, and boom, you know, the last 10 yards is quick and a quick pounce.
All right. And are they social creatures?
No, they're pretty much solitary. These are solitary carnivores. Mom stays with kittens by themselves. They come together at the breeding season time, of course. Males will actually revisit females, so they make a sort of a large – they have much larger home ranges, as I indicated. They kind of travel around visiting different females. But they remain solitary most of the time, and they're quite independent. Once they become independent individuals, that is, the kittens grow old enough, they establish their own home range, and they really basically never see their offspring or their parents again.
Edith is on the line next from Des Moines. Hi, Edith.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, I'm wondering if bobcats kill the young that aren't in their bloodline. The male, like with the big cats, if they come out of pride and that's not their kittens,
right?
But
so
they're taking over the pride,
right? So you're referring to things like lions, for example, that are much more social, and in those kinds of cases, because they have a different social system. They've evolved different kinds of behaviors, including kind of this infanticide where they will actually kill the offspring of another sire. Bobcats, it probably happens occasionally, but it happens not in the same way at all because they're not socially associated with one another. So they really have a very different social system, and they would they might actually kill a kitten for prey. That is, a big male might see a kitten and decide to kill it for prey, but not because of some social structure or infanticide like
and trying to control the gene
the
pool.
Social cats in Africa.
All right. And Edith, you also, your mom decided not to move to a farm because she saw a bobcat once?
Well, yeah, we don't know if she really saw a bobcat or not, but she didn't like the house and she didn't like the place at all. And so she, when we were driving by taking another look at it, she saw a bobcat and she was sure that it would come in and kill her little baby chickens. And so she took that farm off the place, off the list of potentials.
Well, Edith, I'm sure your mom's not the only person in the world who has felt nervous about bobcats. We tend to be quite nervous about any of the predators that live amongst us. Is that a danger, Bill?
We get very few reports of any kind of depredation problems. Nowhere near the kinds of reports you get with, for example, coyotes around farms. We get very, very few reports of attacks by bobcats. They're seen around farmsteads occasionally and so on. But we get much more concern expressed by sportsmen saying, well, they're having an influence on the turkey population, or they're having an influence on, the pheasant population, which is not really the case, but that's where the concern seems to come from. And I can't recall that I've had a person at a public meeting say to me, well, bobcat got into my chickens and killed a bunch of my chickens.
Now, we have had a couple of cougar sightings in Iowa in the last couple of years, which, of course, are much larger cats and larger predators, and people tend to be very nervous about cougars. Are bobcats any kind of a threat to, let's say, our pets, dogs, cats, or even people?
Certainly not to people. They're much smaller, as I said earlier, than you might think, and more secretive, so to speak. You're not likely to even see them, let alone have any kind of an encounter with them. So no danger there. They certainly, around farmsteads and so on, they're natural predators. If there was a small dog or something, I have no doubt in my mind that under the right circumstances, the bobcat could kill a small dog, but they really aren't going to bother. They have so many, other prey out there that they're not likely to come around, looking for food in the farmsteads and so on. So really not, any kind of a threat that one would really be concerned about relative to, accidental, take of somebody's cat or dog around the farm.
Kevin is on the line next from Des Moines. Hi, Kevin.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, we bought a house on the south side of Des Moines in 2005, and it's in a fairly wooded area, and we did a lot of regrading of the yard because of drainage, and so by the spring of 2006 and again in 2007, when the spring thaw came out, it was still pretty muddy. And we, both years, we got two very clear and long sets of prints just passing by the front door. And we took plaster casts, and a number of them had no claws visible. Some of them on a slope where it slipped a little had claws visible. So it was, very definitely a cat. And they were 2 or 3 inches across. And several wildlife kind of people in the area said, oh, that's definitely a bobcat. And it must have happened in the very early morning because we pass by it every day and, going out the front door.
And you're in a pretty urban area?
Yeah, we're just near the airport. But, there's dense woods, lots of rabbits. I guess I'm just wondering how many bobcats come through town and how common is that? We don't know what happens when the thaw is not coming out of the ground, because they're not living prints.
Oh, well, that's a fascinating story, Kevin. Bill?
Right. So certainly you're on the edge of where bobcats could occur. And, we actually had one that dispersed up to the south edge of Des Moines, kind of over by Carlisle in the southeastern corner there, one of our radioed cats. So they do get up there. They're certainly not common, and they're not going to be found around suburban neighborhoods. Nowhere near as common, for example, as foxes and even coyotes are in suburban neighborhoods in some parts of Des Moines. The tracks are fairly distinctive. Charity mentioned earlier, my webpage, there's a really nice set of pictures of tracks and ways to identify the tracks. Bobcat tracks are almost round in profile, so they're about 2 inches long, 2 inches wide, maybe 2.5. But they have a very distinctive central pad. What we call the interdigital pad, basically their palm, has a little M shape to it, and it's very distinctive. And in a soft medium like mud, you'll often be able to see that. And it's very different than a dog. So especially the front part of that pad has a little divot in it. It's a kind of M shape. There's two lobes on the front. In a dog or any of the dog relatives like a fox or a coyote, it looks like an inverted V, so that top of that would have a single lobe on it, and that's one of the most diagnostic ways to tell the difference between cat and dog tracks, whether they're domestic cats or bobcats or any of the dog family. And so sometimes that's what I tell people to look for the most. And there's some great pictures on the web where you can look at the differences in the shapes and so on. Tracks are notoriously difficult to identify in all kinds of media because, of course, the animal, as you mentioned, they slip and slide. They're in, you know, soft spots one place, and the next time their foot goes down, they hit a hard spot. You know, you see them in sand or mud and whatever, and after a while, you know, you have to look at a lot of tracks before you become consistent. The other thing I tell people to really look at is the actual path. People have a tendency to look at the individual tracks and try to identify. But what I think they should concentrate on, or at least pay as much attention to, is looking at the path that the animal is taking. Imagine that you just sort of let your dog out the back door of your house, and you kind of envision exactly what's going to happen. The dog is going to run out of the into the yard and run in a zigzag path all over the place, right? When you let your cat out, what does the cat do? It kind of strolls leisurely in one direction in a straight line and heads to wherever it thinks it's going. And that's really a good description of the difference in the paths. Dogs tend to sidetrack a lot more. They tend to move around in much more wiggly kinds of lines and paths, and cats tend to go in a much more directed way, and they walk in a, the tracks themselves actually stay in more or less a straight line, whereas the dogs tend to kind of cut a diagonal in each of their four steps and then repeat along the path of travel. So they're really good ways to follow the animal and get more hints about whether you're looking at a dog track or a cat track.
Do bobcats spend a lot of time in trees?
They stay in wooded areas because but not necessarily they can climb very well, and we've actually captured individuals up in trees with snares and things like that when we've had an animal that's gotten tangled. But they generally don't spend a lot of time in trees above ground. They like to use trees as escape from danger. And in Iowa, the reason that they stay in these more wooded areas and so on is that they're really staying away from coyotes. So they tend to, you know, have kittens in big brush piles and places where coyotes can't get to their kittens. And when a bobcat is threatened by, for example, a coyote, well, it can scramble up into a tree really quickly. So it's one of the reasons why you don't find them so much in open grassland areas or out in the cornfields and soybean fields and that sort of thing.
How large do you think the population of bobcats could grow to be in Iowa?
You know, Charity, I get asked that question a lot, and I'm not really sure. It's going to continue to grow, and exactly how much more it grows, it's not going to get a lot bigger. There's some room for growth. I don't think that all of southern Iowa is completely saturated. There's certainly habitat that's unoccupied in northeastern Iowa. I think we're seeing some expansion in some parts of east central Iowa, some of the counties there. So it could continue to grow. How many more? Boy, that's a tough, you know, we've actually done projections to try to see where, you know, the population has adequate habitat across the entire state based on those BOE surveys where, you know, we've compiled all that data. I don't know. It could get maybe twice as big as it is now, but I'm guessing probably it won't even get that large.
Bill, thank you so much. Iowa State University Ecology Professor William Clark here with us today. He's been studying the bobcat population in Iowa. And as I mentioned before, we put up a link to his bobcat page on our Facebook page. If you go to our Facebook page at Iowa Public Radio, you can follow that link and find out a lot more about bobcats and also see a lot of great pictures as well. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Sarah Bowden, Emily Woodbury and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Alyssa Weiss. Podcasting and on-demand audio of Talk of Iowa are available at iowapublicradio.org. You can send us email anytime, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, The Broken Cord, a play that brings together the personal stories of people with memory loss and those who care for them. Talk of Iowa is a production of IPR News.